Welcome back to Leveraging Leadership, where we unpack the art of business leadership. I'm your host, Emily Sander, Chief of Staff turned Executive Leadership Coach. And this show is all about finding your greatest points of influence and leveraging them to better serve those around you. Today, we are joined by guest Nathan Leanne. And Nathan, you are currently a fractional Chief of Staff, but you were a full-time Chief of Staff before. So I want to unpack those things in the show today. But first of all, welcome and thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Beautiful. So can you rewind us a little bit and tell us what you were doing before the first time you were Chief of Staff and what led into that role?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I started my career in the investment bank at JP Morgan in the industrials group, mainly doing aerospace and defense and transportation, logistics, M&A, you know, all the investment banky stuff. Did that for just over a year and kind of realized that, you know, there was a level of ownership that was lacking within the bank. You know, you took kind of one project from zero to one and then you handed off, not quite unlike a startup, but at least you have some sort of, you know, you have a level of ownership there and accountability for how 1 to 100 goes. And so that was kind of important to me. And so I left to go to a fintech startup for a few months before I transitioned over to Nate, which is ultimately where I became a chief of staff. The journey there, though, is I'd say talking to people who have gone through the chief of staff journey, you know, yourself included, like there's a few different ways that people get in. I'd say the two biggest ways are probably you come as a chief of staff or you get internally promoted into the chief of staff role. I'm of the latter. I joined actually to help scale the marketing team and the growth function. Prior to that, we were growing somewhat unsustainably. And so it was pulled in to kind of help out with making sure that we were spending money in an as capital efficient way as possible. And then ultimately through that experience was moved into the strategic finance org as we got into a little bit of a cash constrained, tricky situation, if you will. And through that proved myself enough to the point where the executive team kind of felt comfortable pulling me into the office of the CEO. It was an incredible experience. I'd say I did that for, close to a year, before we ultimately wound down, unfortunately. I've been doing fractional work since then.
Sounds good. Thanks for sharing that. So in your first 90 days, if you remember your first 90 days in the chief of staff role, what was that like? Do you remember anything? Was that a blur or were there surprises? What were the first 90 days like?
Definitely a blur. I would say no glaring surprises because I'd been at the company for, you know, over a year, maybe a year, over a year before I was pulled in to the chief of staff role. So I kind of knew what was broken, what was working, and there was nothing like I was senior enough at the time already that I knew about the bureaucracy and like the dynamics amongst the executive team. I think that was probably that probably would have been the craziest thing for me to kind of figure out, but I had already had that epiphany moment before of like, all right, these execs work well together. These execs don't work well together. This is how you convince this exec to do X, and this is how you convince that one to do Y. Like a lot of the pieces that you have to navigate to be successful, I think, within the first 90 days, I'd already navigated that because just by nature of the fact that I was there. So I would say no glaring surprises, but it was certainly a blur. I can't quite remember even what exactly I did. I think the official transition probably came around at the time where we went through this like 1 week sprint where we were, you know, very de minimis runway. And it was like, all right, we got to save this company somehow. So we went through a 1 week crazy exercise of like, unfortunately, like here is what we need to do from an accounts payable perspective. Here's what we need to do for our like getting cash in the door and how can we accelerate certain things. And that process probably marked the transition, the formal transition into the role, but I would say I was doing it in a pseudo capacity already. So to that end, then the first 90 days were probably like, let's save the company. So pretty crazy time to jump into the role. There was focus on how do we reduce burn? How can we raise money? And then there was also a Series B element here as well of let's get all the docs in order and the ducks in order, so to speak. And then also, you know, it was end of the year. So it's like, all right, let's also think about the 2023 plan. Like what, let's say by some miraculous stroke of luck, we pull off this save, like we need a plan for next year too. So like, let's get that together too. So I think that was probably like a crazy first 90 days, but that's probably where that formal transition happened. Yeah.
Yeah. That what you described made me think of like, you're in a boat and you're like bailing water. And then you're also trying to like chart the course of like, okay, if the boat survives, where do we need to go and navigate us?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And as you can imagine, that was tough because we were a relatively transparent company, I would say, at least especially amongst the executive team. So it was tough on that last piece too, because everyone is nervous about their job security. And it's like, well, I want this raise to succeed, but it's like for everyone in everyone's head, right? It's natural. It's if this raise doesn't succeed, why am I spending hours every day figuring out what we're going to do in 2023 instead of recruiting so that I have job stability and job continuity? Because unlike me, and I'm fortunate in this case, a lot of them had kids or a lot of them had, you know, they had people they needed to take care of. So that was tough of like, how can you get people inspired enough to care while being empathetic enough also to be like, look, if this doesn't work out, you should be spending your time right now looking for your next thing.
Yeah.
Because if not, like, how are you going to pay the bills? You know? And so that was like a really delicate balance of like, it was easy for me to take a pail and just try to, you know, talk water out of the boat, but like, you know, I didn't have all of those pressures, you know, so that was hard to get the full alignment there.
You kind of have to be of two minds in that space, because you got to like think about survival in one sense, but also in the future and keeping people motivated, which I think is a really important point. Because I remember when we were going through COVID and like we were going through contingency plans of how large our RIF would need to be, you know, if certain things transpired. And I remember sitting there with my principal and the CFO and our COO, and we literally were writing down names, and I had to offer my name in some of those contingency plans as like, okay, let me step out of myself for a second. What's best for the business would be this and this and this to happen, which was a very surreal moment when I was like, let me write my own name on this list. Yeah. But that was what's best. Yeah. So you kind of have to play that role. But I do want to go back to something you said. So you mentioned the two routes to chief of staff are often an external hire, bringing in a chief of staff from outside, mm-hmm. and then an internal promotion, which is what you had. And you mentioned the advantage of that is you know all the players. You know all the people on the leadership team and the intricacies and nuances. What I've found with people who move into that role from an internal role, especially when they're at EA before, is it takes a little bit for people to see them as the chief of staff instead of what they were before. So I was just wondering, did you run into any of that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say not really. And I'm really, really fortunate in that, because I definitely have, you know, the chief of staff community, because of how nascent it is not tight from the perspective of I know every single chief of staff, but like I know enough within the New York startup ecosystem to have heard a lot of these kinds of stories as well. And I guess I'm fortunate in that the idea of me being chief of staff was something that was broached when I was still on the marketing team, like within my first few months there. I mean, I think I came in with a lot of just let's get shit done attitude. And for some, you know, I was invited to join maybe, yeah, the second board meeting of my time there. So the Q1 22 board meeting, I was invited to join that dinner with the whole executive team and the board members. Or actually, the board members were not there. The board members and the CEO had their own dinner, and then the rest of us had our own dinner. And then the CEO joined us later. But anyway, I was invited to go there with like pretty much the whole executive team. And I think since that moment, the seed had already been planted that should there be a need for a chief of staff, like I would fill that position. So I was really fortunate in that there was no real pushback or, you know, fear that I would be taking over something that someone else was taking over, because we had already figured out kind of how I would work with everyone. I I'd say I was fortunate in that I had a lot of executive sponsorship and influence from my, where even, for instance, let's just take the 2023 planning process. Like, he was deep in the Series B raise because that's very much so founder led. So we kind of triaged and split up the responsibility such that I was doing the planning. And it was very clear from the get-go that like I was the one who was going to do all of this and everyone needed to fall in order, where I didn't have the best purview on what each individual function should be handling, but I was the person that had been tasked with keeping everything in order and making sure that things ran smoothly and making sure that the discussions were productive. And it was very clear to everyone. But again, I don't think that would have been possible without a lot of without a lot of work on both my end and the CEO's end to make sure that there was no, you know, change in control, continuity, hiccups.
Okay, so it sounded like you were pretty lockstep with your principal and you set that transition up well. So it wasn't a surprise to anyone. It wasn't threatening to anyone.
Yeah, that's right.
And sometimes it's, you know, relatively little things like going to the dinner with the board and the executive team. So the optics of something can lead itself.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Different situations right. too. So, right. All right. So that was your first round as chief of staff, your full-time one. What were some key realizations or kind of takeaways coming out of that role, would you say?
Oh, it's a great question. Key realization, which maybe shouldn't be a key realization, is how hard it is to run a company. And I don't mean that from like a very tactical, like there's a lot of stuff that's broken and you got to fix it and you got to always think about growth and all that. I mean more so like, yeah, there's so much nuance in human interaction that I don't think I fully appreciated, because I was never really a manager. I mean, like when I became chief of staff, I had three direct reports because we didn't really know where to put them. Not because like they fully, like my role as a manager was to make sure that they felt like their needs were being heard and that they were progressing in their career. But I had no clue really what they were working on when, because they worked with other teams, but they like reported to me because we didn't know where to slot them. All that is to say, like I was in IC for the longest time. I've been in IC for the longest time. Even in banking, you're the most junior person. Like, you're not exposed to the nuance of daily human interaction and influence and this subtle tug of war that happens. And I think being at that level and having that bird's eye view and having access to the executive team, where like, I'm not really an executive. I kind of sit between the CEO and the executives, but like from a seniority perspective, I sit between the executives and the directors. Like, you know, like it's such a strange role. And there's just a lot of empathy that you need to have, I think. And I didn't fully appreciate that going into it. Also because it's tough when you disagree with your principal. So in my case, the CEO, because my role was and is to best represent the CEO's vision and their ideas and the direction that the company needs to go in. But behind closed doors, I might like firmly disagree with what we're doing. But I can't, you know, that's not my job. Like my job is to make sure that people are aligned with where the CEO wants the company to go and what we need to be doing. And that was also probably a very tough thing to realize. But it's, you know, it's just it is the reality of the role.
And I think, you know, I remember I would vehemently disagree with my principal on certain things, like, oh, like, how can you not see this? And I remember there were conversations where he and I would go at it pretty hard and we would throw down. There was a decision that was made. And at that point, you have to execute that decision as best you can. And as you say,
totally,
you know, represent and work on behalf of the CEO and their direction. So I think that's also a skill. You have to have both points of that, though. It's not a yes person type of scenario. You have to be able to share feedback and share your opinion where it's appropriate. And then you have to be able to go execute to something where you disagree and you execute to it, which is tough.
Absolutely.
It's tough sometimes.
Yeah. It is. It certainly is. Yeah. It requires, maybe this is a really messed up way of depicting it, but it's almost like you have to brainwash yourself a little bit. and brainwash less so in the sense of blindly accept, but brainwash in the sense of you've vehemently disagreed with the points that were made, but you have to convince yourself that those points are compelling, because those are the points that like ultimately are like, that's the reason why a decision was made. Right. And so you kind of have to force yourself to buy into that to some degree.
Yeah.
And that part was definitely tough.
Yeah. And a last point I'll make there are points I disagreed on, but I always understood where he was coming from. So I think I was lucky in that sense, where I was never like, how are you even getting to that? I understood how he was getting to that. I just disagreed with it.
Yeah.
But I was like, all right, I can see how that is a possibility. And so you know what?
Yeah.
That could be true. And you could be right. And that could be the best path to go forward. So I think I always had that. So just to throw there. So transitioning us a little bit, what is a fractional chief of staff, or at least in your iteration of it? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. I qualify a little bit in that, and you and I have talked about this. And so for my own benefit, I guess, of framing this discussion, I call myself a fractional chief of staff mainly because my work across different clients represents what a single chief of staff would likely do at a single company. Insofar as there are clients that I work with where I mainly work in a finance capacity, whether that is, let's think about the fundraise, let's think about the sale process, or there's things that are a little bit mixed between finance and data, where it's like, let's think about our unit economics and let's think about how we should monetize and is this the right business model for us, all the way through to, is this the right go-to-market strategy for us? Whether that's, what is the media buying strategy on the marketing side, or what is the sales motion, or how can we expand distribution? Those are things that I think chiefs of staff and those, you know, those who are chiefs of staff can probably resonate with. It's like, those are things that you would solely own or wholly own at a single company. But for me, I'm not a chief of staff at every single company. I definitely own only one function and one pillar within each company. But I think that, you know, that's only natural given the level of depth and the level of time you need to spend to understand a single company in order to make decisions across multiple pillars is just far too much, both for me and for my clients. It's not justifiable if I'm not on their team full time. So just want to make that sort of qualification there on how I personally see the fractional chief of staff role.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was, so on average, let me ask this, on average, how many projects do you have at one time?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say two anchor clients with many sort of tertiary. I wouldn't even say secondary. Mainly because it's sort of like, it's secondary is, you know, there's a little bit of oomph there. Tertiary, it's like on an as-needed basis. But there's like two sort of anchors where it's, you know, this is the commitment. This is what you're doing. And like, you know, boom. You know, the reality here, though, is you're always trying to build a pipeline of projects. And so at any given time, there could be more that take up a significant amount of time, but I would not classify them as anchor clients just because these anchor clients for me are much more evergreen of there is no real end date in sight. I would say 2 plus a few.
All right. So we'll use 3 as a number just for example purposes. So I was kind of thinking about this and I'm like, I had a lot on my plate with one chief of staff job. I had to build that relationship with my principal and we were talking multiple times a day with other executives, with the planning and all the different fires that would come up in one company. And if you expand that by 3, that's a lot. That's a lot going on. That's a lot to keep track of. Yeah. So you kind of mentioned it's a little bit more limited in scope in what you do. Is the interaction you have with the principal or executive team more limited as well? Or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a good question. With the quote unquote principal, usually it's the CEO or founder for me right now. Interactions, I don't think are significantly different, but definitely with the rest of the executive team, it's sort of not purposely designed to be like on an as needed basis. It's not like some sort of, you know, clearance thing where it's like on a need to know basis kind of a situation. It's just more like, it's not worth it for me or for that executive to spend a lot of time together because we're not going to be working together too much. So it's sort of like, I'll just use one client as an example. It's within the generative AI space. We're building a workflow automation solution. For instance, I'm involved enough there where on Wednesday, we just did a webinar for how to leverage AI automation in underwriting to improve risk assessments and to improve operational processes. I'm fully just like a fractional chief of staff, but I was the one who moderated that fireside chat, right? And so like, there's a lot of involvement that I have with these companies, but it's only with the CEO and then like whoever else is necessary. So within this client, for instance, that executive is the VP of sales. Beyond that, like I don't really interact with the VP of customer success. I don't really interact with the engineering team just because I don't really need to. It's similar, but different. And I would say from I think you had mentioned this, and if you didn't, stop me, but I think there was an element too of like, it takes time to build a relationship and build a trust and things of that sort. And for that, I would say I've been fortunate where everyone that I currently work with, I knew for a few months and at least, and had multiple conversations with them, coffees with them to jam on their business. Like, oh, I don't understand why you're doing that. Why are you doing that? Or have you ever thought about this? Like, maybe this is something interesting that you should be thinking about. Or, oh, cool. Like, that's great progress. Like, how can I help? That months long nurturing of the relationship makes it really easy to just jump in like right away. And I would say for most of these teams too, fractional chief of staff only really works at the early stage because why would you bring in a fractional finance person, let's say, or a fractional sort of, I don't know, rev ops person when you're at a certain scale? Like you need someone there full time who wholly owns it and builds the processes and knows the processes and can hire a team. Like you don't want a fractional person. And I bring that up only because the amount of trust that early stage employees have of the CEO by nature of the fact that they joined a company that doesn't have product market fit yet and they're fully trusting the CEO to make it work. There's a lot of trust on every single decision that the CEO makes. So if the CEO decides to bring someone in, it's like, okay, cool. I guess this person's dope. probably smart. We should probably trust him because the CEO trusts him. And we probably left some really cushy job somewhere to jump here, get paid nothing, and believe in the company and believe in the CEO. Like, the dynamic lends itself well to being able to be successful the second you come into an org.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because, you know, if you're at a more mature company, it's like this fractional chief of staff, yet that's supposed to be integrated and embedded in the leadership team and know everything. But I think to your point, at those early stage companies, it's a much different dynamic. That's a different game altogether. And you know the company by having those conversations for months on end beforehand. So that's where you, I imagine you kind of learn the lay of the land and the strategy and the, you know, the thesis for the product or for the company. And then you can, you know, almost plug and play into like a webinar for marketing, because I know where this fits in the overall picture. So you still have that big picture. It's just kind of a little bit different setup for a fractional chief of staff.
Yep, that's right. That's right. Even for that company, for instance, there's a lot of people who are executing on the sort of overall go-to-market, but there's no one who has sat down to really spend the time building out the go-to-market strategy of all of the different components of growth marketing, sales, lifecycle marketing, content marketing. Like to your point, that's something where the CEO and I, because of that relationship, like the two of us now are diving deep to know, and I have enough trust, thankfully, where I can kind of get whatever information I need to help put this thing together. It's really, really important to build that trust. Also, because at least for me, this is so cliche, but time being your most valuable resource, it's just like, I'd rather, there's so many cool companies. I'm not going to spend my time with a company that I don't believe in, because A, that's not fair to them, and B, that's not fair to my own time, because, you know, cash is important, but it's not that important where, you know, I'll just do anything, just to bridge.
How do you decide which projects to take on?
I just have to really like the CEO, to be honest. I don't really have a strong screen for which project types I take on, right? Like I have finance, I have rev ops, I have marketing, kind of all of that flavor and standard ops throughout. And also from a business perspective, you know, there's AI companies, there's very kind of boring legacy businesses, there's consumer companies. It's a bit all over the place. So I don't have a strong screen there. It's more of, do I like the CEO's person? And do I think that they're building a company that, yeah, is cool? Yeah, like it sounds so elementary, but it's truly that. It's, do I like the CEO? Do I like the company? And do I think I could work here? And I guess more importantly, do I think I can add value here? Mm. So like if someone is telling me to come in to be a part-time engineer, you know, even if I loved the company and I loved the CEO, I would not join a company to be the part-time engineer. Not because I don't think engineering is cool. I would love to be an engineer. I just can't code. It's, you know, it's not in the company's best interest either. So that I think is important to me too. Like if there's something where it will take me a meaningful amount of time to figure out, I think that's okay. But it's definitely an expectation that needs to be set up front of like, when you're hiring someone fractionally, you probably don't want to spend that much time onboarding them. And hopefully they could just jump in right away. And so making sure that it's very clear, like where you can add value, I think is really important for me as well. Cause otherwise then it's you're not really burning a relationship, but you're kind of burning a relationship. Yeah. Because it almost feels like you misled, you know, that person, like you misrepresented your abilities.
It's almost, I feel like you have a very high threshold and you kind of know it when you see it type of thing. Like, oh, when I get that, like, hell yes, let's do this. Otherwise,
totally. It's, yeah.
you know, let me pass and find and be patient and find something else. So
yeah, totally.
So you're kind of playing like 3D chess, because as I mentioned, you've got like a full-time chief of staff job in one sense, even though it's limited. And then you're like timesing that by 3 or 4 or 5. So how do you stay organized? How do you keep yourself on track for all those different projects and all the different variations and nuances within each project?
Yeah. I wouldn't say I'm the most organized. I've very much so leaned into this concept of the second brain, which is an exercise that I learned from my last CEO at Nate. He was a big proponent of like, just dump everything into one place where you could easily find information and access information and see decisions that were made, why they were made, how they were made, when they were made, and et cetera, et cetera. So I just have like a really crazy notes system, I would say, which is not, yeah, again, it's not super groundbreaking, and it's certainly not, it's, if you looked at it, you'd probably be like, what is going on? But it works for me. I kind of know where things are and where things, like, yeah, I know how this system works for me. But the big thing I think is less so remembering the nuance of each company and what needs to be done. And it's more so how to time box things and schedule things in a way that's the most effective. Because I think, you know, there's nothing too different about getting super deep in each company. It's almost like getting super deep in different projects at a single company. Obviously, there's like one generalized context that you can operate within, but still, and you get my point. It's not that different from like a tracking tasks perspective. It's more so the context switching of different projects within different companies, though, is a much higher threshold for, or it's a much higher switching cost, I would say, of jumping from one client to another, and contextualizing why you're doing what you're doing. So for that, it's really important for me to make sure that I have hours long time boxes for each client. And that also means that when Slacks come in, when I'm on a different client, I just do not respond. Unless it's like crazy, crazy urgent, like then call me. But if it's a Slack message, like if I'm not working on what you like, if I'm not working on your thing, I'm not looking at your thing. It doesn't matter. You know,
like some lines of demarcation there for.
Yeah, it's very much so. Otherwise, the context switching would just crush me.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I couldn't imagine. Yeah. And like, God forbid you kind of mention something like, oh, that's not yours, because you're going back and forth too fast.
Yeah, exactly. Like saying some revenue number and it's like,
oh gosh, that's not our revenue. No. Just kidding. It's like, that's totally wrong, Nathan. I know, I was just testing you, just making sure we're paying attention.
Yeah. I want to make sure you know the numbers. Yeah.
What do you use, a note taking system or tool, or just like Notepad, Google Docs, or?
Yeah, Google Docs.
That's
Docs.
That's what I do.
It's really, let's get really tactical here. So I have a Notion page. Again, this is a little funky. So I have a Notion page with all of the clients that I have, like active and inactive clients, but like clients that I have signed engagement letters with. Those, every single relevant link is like literally just like listed. Okay. It's really, really messy, but it's like, all right. Let's say client A, and it's, here's the Google Drive folder. Here are the key notes, and I'll double click on how I do that. Here are the key files for easy access, and blah, 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 blah. But here are the key people, whatever. It's like all in one Notion page. And in each note, I just have a note that is just infinitely long, basically based off of. So for instance, if there's like a weekly call, then it's like, okay, weekly blank. And then it's everything in one note versus like every single call is a separate note. Cause then I actually would not know where anything is. And so like, that's how I break down, at least from the notes side. And then for all prospects, I also do a lot on like the VC side, not as an angel, but like I'm able to meet companies through this process, and I have a few relationships within the VC ecosystem. So to the extent there are companies that I meet with that are interesting, I'll shoot them over. But anything that has to do with that side is in Apple Notes, which is a good. So, you know, that's like a little bit messed up is like people that I meet, companies that I talk to, VCs that I talk to. It's all in this like folder in Apple Notes that I have titled professional. And it's just a mess, but it's like broken down by company. And then each company is, again, dates, name I talk to, notes. We're getting really tactical here, but that's how I kind of keep track of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've like bifurcated like prospects and existing clients by like the system it's in.
Yeah, exactly. So it helps me kind of figure out, the physical act of going to another application and the difference in the UI subconsciously maybe helps me figure out like where I am and what I'm doing. My calendar is gross. I feel like I should have it color coded, but it's not color coded. Like I was always like, why would you ever color code something, until now where I definitely spend a lot more time now just making sure, like, oh, is this a meeting or did I time box this to be like heads down time? So I don't know, maybe after this call, I'm going to go in and color code my calendar.
But, I'm on the brink. It's funny you mentioned that. Sorry to cut you off. I'm on the brink of color coding my calendar. I've resisted it for a long. I'm like, this is too many colors. It's too much. I was like, no, I need to be able to tell at a glance, like what that is. So no, I totally.
Yeah, exactly. 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 But yeah, it's that subtle design that helps for sure.
Yeah. So you've talked to so many leaders and you've been a part of different companies. What type of company or leader would benefit most, I guess, from a chief of staff? Like, are there certain, okay, when it's set up like this, or when you have a leader like that, it's really conducive to a chief of staff. Whereas if you've got this going on, you don't really need a chief of staff, or it might be not the right time for that.
It's a great question. I think a general heuristic is if you're pre-Series A, you probably could benefit from someone who's just like generally smart that could plug and play quickly that you don't need to ramp up, right? Like there's no shortage of things to do at a pre-seed or seed stage company. There's always something that's broken. There's always something that needs to be done that keeps dropping in the priority list. Like, It kind of depends. Like, I would say it's less so what types of companies that benefit, and it's sort of what types of chiefs of staff should pre-Series A companies look for in a fractional capacity. And I mean that more so from the perspective of like, the reason I say any pre-Series A company could use help is because there's execution work that needs to be done always. And you could benefit from a fractional chief of staff from that perspective. There's also strategic work that needs to be thought through. That you could also benefit from a fractional chief of staff. So it's less of company and CEO, and it's more so, what do you need? Like, if you need someone to help build out your, tech stack or something, because it's very tactical and it's purely execution. Like, you could bring someone in for that, but it's a different type of chief of staff, right? There's a different type of profile versus if you need someone to help with like, oh, I don't really know how I should be thinking about my unit economics because I've just kind of fingered to the wind. It works for now, but we're getting to a point where I need to be a little bit, you know, more serious about how we think about the financials. Okay, then it's a little bit different. Then it's more of a thought partner who's done it before, right? Or so I would say it's more on the company to figure out what's the best profile versus which company's fractional people should want to work for. I mean, I guess actually that's unfair. To unpack that, then it's most pre-seed and seed companies could probably use a fractional chief of staff. If you're trying to do the fractional chief of staff thing, it's purely, you just got to get in front of the CEO. Those obviously are the most beneficial, but you get in front of them, have a conversation and see if there's a fit. Like whether they need a strategic person or an execution person, or they just need someone to sense check them. And it's like more sort of tertiary and you have like a weekly call or whatever that may be. That's probably how you figure out which ones make the most sense for your skill set and where you want to focus your time.
Yeah, I like that because it does have to deal with the profile of the chief of staff. There are so many different kinds of chiefs of staff. It's, you know, making sure that's a match on that level too. So yeah, thank you for sharing that and outlining that. As we close here, is there anything else that you would just offer as a word of advice or encouragement to fellow chiefs of staff?
Yeah, I would say advice is you got to love it. You got to love like getting your hands dirty. I mean, it's a part of my French, like a shit show everywhere. But it doesn't matter where you go. It's not like, oh, or even let's just say within one company, it's not like, oh, you get this project over the line and then the next one is like chill. Like it's not. You're going back to basics. Like how did I ramp on this concept that I had no clue about before? And am I willing to do that again? And like, I put in so much effort here and it didn't work. Like, am I willing to go through that potential, you know, kick in morale? And that's probably the biggest thing. Like, if you don't actually enjoy getting down and dirty in the details and the chaos, then it's probably not for you. That being said, I will caveat, like, there is a certain threshold and point where it's just too chaotic, where it's a lost cause. And, you know, at that point, maybe extract yourself from the situation. But, you know, there is a lot of chaos everywhere. And you have to be comfortable with that. But again, I do want to qualify that. There are definitely companies where the chaos is too much, where maybe it's not worth it.
I think it's a good point. Anywhere you go, it's never going to be easy. It's never going to be a cakewalk. But you have to be one of those people who gets excited about like, let me get my hands dirty. Let me get in this and help me, you know, sometimes bring order to that chaos or like on the edge of chaos, like bring it back a little bit and help the team. So totally. I think you've got to be willing to go in there and get dirty and get messy. That's just part of being a chief of staff. So
yeah. It's part of early stage, you know. That's just the reality, early stage company.
But it's so fun too. It's so great. Like you're in there, you're, you know, shoulder to shoulder with people and you're doing something great and hopefully worthy mission wise. And that's a great feeling to kind of be in the trenches in that sense. So yeah.
Totally.
Thank you for that. Well, thank you, Nathan. This has been a great conversation, and you're our first fractional chief of staff. So you've kind of cracked that open for us, but appreciate your insights and appreciate great. How you approach what you do. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. This was really fun.
Awesome. All right. Talk to you soon, my friend.
If you'd like some more information on the topic discussed in this episode, head over to nextlevel.coach and click on the resources page for some helpful free downloads.